We got the end of Genesis today, and the passing of both Joseph and Jacob. And what I want to talk to you about, I got this from Rabbi Sacks years ago, who got it from a Rabbi Lichtenstein. And what it's talking about is Joseph and his weeping. How many times does Joseph weep? Seven. So he weeps seven times. Now, I don't know about you, but when I see seven of anything in the Bible, I say, oh, I wonder what's going on there. Sevens show up a lot in the Bible, and so the fact that he weeps seven times is significant. In fact, what it does is it tells us something about God, which is going to be interesting. So the first part is he does not weep in response to adversity. So he gets jumped by his brothers, sold into slavery, framed by Potiphar's wife, thrown into jail, abandoned by the wine steward. In none of those cases does he weep. He just pulls up his socks and gets on with his life. Never weeps. He's built himself what I would call a wall of strength. As he goes through these adverse situations, he sees God's hand in his situation, and he steadies himself and he does what needs to be done. His two children, Manasseh means, God has made me forget all my toil and my father's house. And then Ephraim is, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So what he's done is he has gone native, toughened himself up and done what needs to be done. He starts weeping when his family shows up. So all of the weeping that he does is in the context of relationships with his family. His brothers and his father, with the exception of Benjamin, also don't weep. When Benjamin and Joseph come together, the two brothers both weep. But other than that, nobody weeps except Joseph. Jacob weeps when he is presented with his son's bloody coat. You know, he mourns at that point, but thereafter he never weeps. None of the brothers weep. They get on with life. They're very pragmatic. They do whatever needs to be done, and they never miss lunch. So the first time that Joseph weeps is in Genesis 42:24. And that's when the brothers show up. So he finally sees his brothers. And he turned away from them and wept. So his wall of iron resolve, if you will, has been penetrated when his brothers unexpectedly show up. As we've said lots of times before, he's the viceroy of Egypt. He has never used his power, which is considerable, to go check on his family. You know, as viceroy of Egypt, second in command, and Pharaoh says, only with respect to the throne are you behind me. So it would have been entirely possible for him to whistle up a squad of Egyptian cavalry and say, go on up there and check on my family, see what's going on. He never does. And so he has cut himself off from his family. And so his initial weeping is when they show back up and he realizes that there's something that is missing from his life. At this point, he doesn't also show his hand. He turns his back and goes somewhere else and weeps. His brothers never see it. And the reason for that, I think, is because he has really no idea what's going on in the family. Because remember, in this particular family, there is a history of people being thrown out of the family. Ishmael gets thrown out of the family. Esau, in a sense, gets thrown out because Jacob gets the blessing. So the question becomes, did Dad throw me out of the family? Dad's the one that sent me off to my brothers all by myself, and they jumped me. Did Dad set this up? Have I been thrown out of the family? So he doesn't know what's going on yet. And furthermore, we have this conflict between the sons of Rachel and the sons of Leah. So one of the things that he's going to do is he's going to set it up so that if that conflict extends to Benjamin, he will be able to have Benjamin with him, and the rest of the family can go to snot. He doesn't care. So that's sort of what he's setting up. So the second time that he weeps is when Benjamin shows up. Now, he still doesn't know what the family situation is. And then we do the business with the cup, where he hides his cup in the sack and so forth, and snatches Benjamin back. Benjamin is the guy that stole my cup. He's going to be a slave. So what he's done now is he's set himself up so he and his brother are in his control. And if the other 10 brothers say, huh, sayonara, baby, and take off with their grain because they're not willing to do what's necessary to save Benjamin, he's got his brother. The two of us can go on. I'll take care of you. And the rest of the family, we don't care because they don't care about us. So again, he does not weep publicly when he sees his brother. The next time he weeps is in Genesis 45:2. And that's when Judah steps up and does the right thing. Judah has gone surety for Benjamin. Here he's got the viceroy of Egypt that's got Benjamin in firm grip. And he says, no, that can't stand. I have gone surety with my father for that man. I will take his place, send him home. At that point, Joseph knows that this rivalry, if you will, has got a chink in it. It was sort of the way with him, but it doesn't appear to extend to Benjamin. And at that point is when he makes himself known to his brothers, and he and Benjamin weep, but nobody else does. The brothers are sort of gobsmacked, standing there. As I say, they don't miss lunch, but they don't weep. And the question that Joseph is asking now, internally, if you will, is who am I? Because remember, he's gone native. Pharaoh has acted to him like a father. Pharaoh had taken him out of prison. Pharaoh has given him a new suit of clothes. Pharaoh has given him a wife. Pharaoh has given him a job. All of those things are things a father would do for a son. And his loyalty is to Pharaoh. Well, now he's got this whole other set of loyalties that he grew up with. And the question that he's going to be wrestling with from now on is, who am I really? Am I the son of Pharaoh or am I the son of Jacob? What he's finding, obviously, is both are legitimate parts of himself. But what he has done is he is going to pay a terrible price for what he's had to do. When he meets with Benjamin, one of the things that he says is, please come near me. Which is to say, let me be one of you. Let me rejoin the family. And what he's realizing is that in order to save his brothers, in order to save his family, he has got to continue to be the son of Pharaoh. Because if he gives up the job of being son of Pharaoh, then he no longer has the power to bring his family down and take care of them. The price that he has to pay for that power is continued separation from the family. He parks the family up in Goshen, and he has to stay down at headquarters in Thebes, probably, with Pharaoh, because he's still got a kingdom to run. So the power that he has to do them good has come to him with a price. And that price is estrangement still from his family. So the next time he weeps is when his father shows up. He weeps on his father's neck for a good long while. Interestingly, Dad doesn't seem to weep, or at least the scripture doesn't say so. And when his father comes, in a sense, he's no longer alone. Because now his father is there. And then when his father dies, he's alone again. And he weeps over his father. And then the final time that he weeps is when the brothers send to him and say, all right, Dad's dead. So what's this guy going to do? And again, there's a family history here. And the family history is bloodshed between the brothers doesn't start until Dad dies. Remember Jacob and Esau. Esau says, when my father dies, I'm going to kill that little so-and-so. So now what we have is Dad's dead. Joseph is viceroy of Egypt. He has got all the power in the world. Dad's out of the way. What's he going to do with us? And again, Joseph weeps. And he's weeping there because he realizes that he's alone again. His brothers don't trust him. So he's still out there on his own. Now, why is all this important? Well, it tells us something about God. Yeshua also weeps. And he does it how many times? Twice. And he weeps both times in the same context. The context here with Joseph, as Rabbi Sacks describes it, is the limits of power. He's got all the power in the world, viceroy of Egypt, but he cannot compel his brothers to love him and trust him. He just can't. Yeshua has all the power in the world. When he's entering Jerusalem, Luke 19:41, and when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, "Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children with you. And they will not leave a stone upon another because you did not know the time of your visitation." One of the things that he says, "I long to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not." So there's this personal relationship that he wants. He wants Israel to recognize him as a Messiah, recognize him as the one who was sent by God, come together, come back to God, because they've become off in the weeds, and he wants them to come back to God, and they won't do it. They don't trust him. And of course, they wind up killing him. That's the first time he weeps. And it's in the context of the inability of power to coerce personal relationships. The second time he weeps, John 11:33. When Yeshua saw her weeping, Mary, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Yeshua wept. So the Jews say, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Well, of course, the answer is yes. He could have kept this man from dying. But if he kept that man from dying, he would not be able to do something else, which is raise him from the dead after 3 days. So in order for him to be able to do something that was necessary, he had to cause tremendous pain to people that he loved. He couldn't do both. Which is to say, God has all the power in the universe, but there are limits to what God's power can do in the context of personal relationships. Let me put this another way. He certainly could compel you to serve him, but he can't compel you to love him. And he chooses not to compel you to serve him in order that you may choose to come to him freely. Someone who owns a slave has got the work of the slave, but he doesn't necessarily have anything else. And so what we have is this conflict between power and personal relationships. And as I say, this business of Joseph weeping seven times, and I think seven times are to draw your attention to it. The whole point here is to teach us something about the limits of power. Now, what the Torah is, and this is Rabbi Sacks, people like power. We all do. And Peter says that God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. And what he is saying there is humility gives you access to the power of God, but those of you who walk in pride don't have that access. And, oh, by the way, therein lies the temptation to idol worship. Because if you don't have access to the power of God, think of Saul for a minute. Saul's the first king of Israel. Saul proves to be unsuitable. God says, I'm going to give your kingdom to another. At which point, Saul begins to go quite mad. By the end of his life, he is certifiably insane. But he's lost his connection to God. And if you look at Saul's speeches, what he says is, I want you to go kill my enemies. I want you to do this for me. Me, 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 me. And at the end of his days, he winds up consulting a medium, the witch at Endor. He can't get what he wants from God because of his pride, so he has to turn to supernatural things in order to get it. And so the idea of proud people, when they recognize the limits of their power, if they ever do, there's a tremendous temptation there to turn to another source of spiritual power, which is an idol. So as you read this, what you see over and over in Scripture is God rebuking the proud and the powerful and elevating the humble. Moses is your poster child. Remember, Moses says, Moses wrote it, you know, you always get a kick out of this, that he is the most humble of all men. And remember in the incident where Miriam and Aaron take a run at Moses' power? Hey, Moses, why don't you take a long weekend, be with your wife? Miriam and I can handle the nation. And God reaches down and jerks him up. And he says, Moses is not like anybody else. Moses I can speak to face to face. Moses is humble. He didn't want the job. Having gotten the job, he keeps asking me, would you get somebody else? I really don't want all this power. And because he doesn't want all that power, God can trust him with that power. And it's the same thing with Joseph. Joseph didn't want the job. He was just being a 17-year-old guy checking on his brothers when he gets jumped and thrown into circumstances he didn't ask for them. And in all those cases, he behaves humbly and properly. You see it in the incident with Potiphar's wife. You see it in the incident when he tells Pharaoh his dreams. Pharaoh says, I hear you can interpret dreams. Now, if he had been a proud man, he just stuck his hand in his pocket. Yeah, I've interpreted a couple of dreams. One of them by me. I'll see what I get. He doesn't say that. He says, no, I can't. But God can. And I will tell Pharaoh what God has to say. In all cases, it's humility. And that humility is the thing that allows him to be trusted with the power that he has. And what his weeping does is tells you that even with all that power and that trust, there are limits to what he can do in personal relationships. Just as there are limits in what Yeshua could do in personal relationships, and just as there are limits in what God can do in personal relationships. That's the whole story there. So, understand that you can't compel love. Not possible. I assure you that if God can't do it, you can't either.